In the vast, silent expanses of the Mojave Desert, a young Air Force weather observer named Charles Hall documented what would become one of the most compelling and detailed accounts of sustained extraterrestrial contact in modern history. Published in 2002, after being hidden for 18 years, Millennial Hospitality emerged as a cult phenomenon, with early hand-edited copies becoming collector's items. The book's quiet power lies not in sensationalism, but in its methodical, matter-of-fact documentation of the extraordinary. Hall's account resonates with readers seeking authentic encounters beyond government disclosure, earning praise from researchers like Paola Harris, who called it the most important document of interspecies contact in existence. What makes Hall's story unique is how it portrays these beings, dubbed tall whites, not as invaders or saviors, but as complex visitors with their own fears, families, and diplomatic arrangements with human authorities. Hall's account resonates with readers seeking authentic encounters beyond government disclosure, earning praise from researchers like Paola Harris, who called it the most important document of interspecies contact in existence. What makes Hall's story unique is how it portrays these beings, dubbed tall whites, not as invaders or saviors, but as complex visitors with their own fears, families, and diplomatic arrangements with human authorities. Fresh-faced and naive in his Air Force dress blues, I arrived at the Las Vegas train station as a 20-year-old weather observer in the mid-1960s. The famous city, with its flashing lights and scantily clad waitresses, beckoned through Casino Center's doorway, but my assignment lay elsewhere, at the remote Desert Center Air Base and Mojave Wells gunnery ranges. Master Sergeant Walters established my boundaries. I could travel up to 450 miles from base when off duty, a freedom that would prove significant later. My introduction to base life came unexpectedly at the commander's birthday party, where I tactlessly refused to dance with an older woman who turned out to be the major's wife. To my surprise, when summoned to his office Monday morning, he was pleased. I was the only man who doesn't want to dance with my wife, and therefore the only one he could trust around her. This odd encounter foreshadowed the unusual relationships and trust I would develop with authority figures throughout my desert assignment. My first notable achievement came when six F-105 fighters were trapped aloft with dwindling fuel because McIntyre, another weather observer, kept erratically opening and closing the base due to wind conditions. Taking over, I noticed the wind gusts followed a predictable pattern, 1 minute at 50 miles per hour, 1 minute at 15 miles per hour. I timed each plane's approach to ensure they'd land during calm periods between gusts. All six planes landed safely, with the flight leader's engine flaming out from empty tanks just as he touched down. The colonel's praise, "the only reason any of us are still alive," established my reputation as someone who could keep his wits about him in dangerous situations, a quality that would later prove crucial in my extraordinary encounters. Soon after my arrival, I began hearing whispered stories about Range 4 Harry, a mysterious entity that supposedly roamed Range 4 at Mojave Wells. According to Dwight, a fellow airman, Harry was a horse caught in an atomic bomb blast in 1954 at Frenchman Flats. One side of him glowed fluorescent white, he had large blue eyes, a human-like face, and blonde hair. Previous weather observers had been terrified by encounters with Harry, including Rigby and Anderson, who refused to take measurements at Range 4 alone, especially at night. Dwight claimed that he and the major had personally seen Harry one night while sitting quietly in the Range 4 lounge. They observed a glowing white horse-like figure moving silently across the dry lake bed. When the major spoke, Harry quickly fled. After this encounter, the major decided that routine wind measurements would no longer be taken from Range 4 due to the danger. The story of Harry began with a weather observer named Jackson in the 1950s who spotted something white near the mountains northwest of Range 4. Despite being sober at the time, Jackson drove toward the mysterious white patch to investigate. What he found, or what found him, became the foundation of the Range 4 Harry legend. I initially dismissed these stories as elaborate initiation pranks designed to scare newcomers. Yet I couldn't explain why over 30 people had independently claimed to see Range 4 Harry, each description containing similar details despite variations in the overall narrative. Some described Harry as a radioactive horse, others as a prospector with a burrow, and still others as floating patches of light. The consistency in certain details, the fluorescent white appearance, the unusual movement patterns, the intelligence behind the encounters, suggested something more than mere campfire tales. My first indication that something truly unusual was happening came when I discovered my predecessor Sullivan had been falsifying weather readings. He explained his theory about the number 4 being the government's number, claiming it was the most believable number to use when fabricating wind readings. According to him, 3 seemed incomplete, 5 was suspicious, but 4 was trustworthy. He insisted Desert Center was depending on us to provide this number, showing he had a system for creating believable fake readings. More disturbing was Sullivan's terror after an encounter at Range 1. He described seeing an albino coyote that stood upright on its hind legs, able to see over the sagebrush. Despite my skepticism about this impossible creature, Sullivan's arm scar and terror were undeniably real. Back at base, he abruptly handed me his keys, saying he couldn't return to the ranges ever again, and fled within 15 minutes. Later, I discovered the truth. Sullivan had deserted months ago, training others to cover his weather duties while he lived in Long Beach pretending to be discharged. When he called me days later to thank me for keeping a secret, he broke down screaming about white creatures that come in darkness, begging me never to go to the ranges alone. The pattern of abandoned duties became clearer when I visited the Desert Center Supply Depot. An angry Chief Master Sergeant accused me of fraud because I was requisitioning 120 balloons monthly when previous observers had collectively used far fewer. The sergeant showed me records indicating that 59 previous observers had requisitioned only 1,853 balloons total over 6.5 years, with 19 observers requesting none at all. I explained that I was actually performing the required balloon runs 5 times daily, unlike my predecessors who apparently abandoned their duties. I'd even salvaged balloons from the dump, where I found over 1,000 unused balloons still in boxes. This discovery, along with the logbooks recording bizarre incidents and time distortions, painted a disturbing picture. Something at the ranges was frightening observers away from their duties, something they couldn't or wouldn't officially report. My first direct encounter happened while making measurements at my weather station. Noticing my box of white neoprene balloons had mysteriously moved to the edge of my shelf, I began questioning the purpose of my isolated assignment. The Desert Center command post didn't even want my weather reports. They just verified I was present. Spotting movement in the sagebrush quarter mile away, I glimpsed something white. Curious, I ventured out, calling, "Is anyone out there?" Following glimpses of white through the maze-like sagebrush paths, I pursued what I believed might be a lost child. After a strategic game of cat and mouse, I finally cornered the small white figure. To my shock, I discovered not a human child, but a chalk-white creature about 3 feet tall in a white jumpsuit. She had large blue eyes that wrapped unusually far around her head, 4-fingered hands with claw-like nails. Terrified, she trembled before me. I retreated in fear, speaking reassurances as I backed toward my weather shack, offering help and water. As I walked away, I glimpsed a 6-foot-tall adult version of the creature rushing to the small one's location before disappearing behind the sagebrush. Later, sitting stunned in my truck, I tried to process Smokey's cryptic message. The Desert Center base commander, a 2-star general, had somehow known I was sick on a remote desert road and sent thanks. The message was bewildering. Thanks for rescuing a butterfly trapped in thick sagebrush that no one else could reach. The general granted me medical leave, suggested I recover in Los Angeles, and assured me I needn't fear anything white on the ranges. This encounter established a pattern that would repeat throughout my time at the ranges. The beings would approach cautiously, retreat if startled, and military authorities seemed not only aware of their presence, but engaged in some form of relationship with them.
Late one night in my isolated barracks, I sensed something watching me after my shower. Dressing quickly, I fled to my truck and waited. Around 2 a.m., I witnessed a shocking sight. A tall, chalk-white figure with shoulder-length blonde hair and fluorescent aluminum clothing sprinting from the barracks at impossible speed, followed by three similar children. They disappeared into the sagebrush. Minutes later, a male figure followed the same path. I timed them. The female and children ran 25-30 miles an hour, the male about 35 miles an hour. Troubled by the mathematics showing the white male creature moved 2.5 times faster than Olympic athletes, I decided to conduct my own experiment. On a deserted morning at range 3, I carefully measured 100 yards and timed myself running. After multiple attempts, my best speed was under 8 miles an hour, far from the 35 miles an hour I'd witnessed. Refusing to accept this reality, I created a training program, including broad jumps and stone throwing, hoping to prove these beings were merely humans who'd scared me. But my performance only worsened with practice, my broad jumps barely reaching 5 feet on the hard gravel surface. Days later, at midnight near an ice cream stand in Mojave Wells, I spotted two similar white figures walking cautiously through town. They moved oddly close together, their suits seeming to absorb car headlights while generating their own light. When they noticed me, they fled up a canyon at over 30 miles an hour, impossibly fast. Their footprints suggested they weighed only about 90 pounds, despite being nearly 6 feet tall. These observations forced me to confront an uncomfortable reality. Whatever these beings were, they possessed physical capabilities far beyond human limits. Their ability to move at such speeds, their unusual weight-to-height ratio, and their distinctive appearance all pointed to something truly non-human living among us in the desert.
Under the midsummer moon, the desert valley stretching north from Mojave Wells displayed stunning beauty, with cool, musical breezes sweeping over miles of sagebrush meadows. I'd named these beautiful connected valleys the Meadows of Arcturus. Rising quietly at 2:20 a.m. to avoid waking my barracks mates, I prepared in near darkness before slipping outside into the moonlit desert. Driving through the desert at night, I noticed two small, soft white fluorescent lights in the distance, roughly 22 miles away near the branch in the Range 1 road. As I continued driving, I realized these lights had moved closer, now only 18 miles away. There was no wind to explain their movement. After parking at Range 3 in the shadows of the generator building, I quietly performed my weather observation duties, releasing and tracking a balloon while staying virtually undetectable in the moonlight. While taking readings, I spotted the white patches again, now drifting toward me across the desert. Through my theodolite at 75x magnification, I could see they were two humanoid figures, one about 6'9" tall, the other 5'7", floating 7 inches above the gravel road, giving off a soft white fluorescent glow. When I briefly used my flashlight to check my watch, the figures abruptly retreated a mile back down the road and hid in the sagebrush, occasionally peering at me before disappearing completely. Using my theodolite, I occasionally glimpsed the tall white patch looking at me from behind the sagebrush before it ducked down permanently. I then spotted a third white fluorescent figure drifting northeast toward an ammunition bunker, revealing itself as a tall, thin man in a chalk-white aluminum jumpsuit with an open helmet taking unusually high steps. Two more white patches were moving hurriedly along the mountains to join him. Strange thoughts entered my mind, suggesting I ignore what I was seeing, followed by an unnatural wave of fear that disappeared as quickly as it came. When I moved to get a better view, I saw the two original white patches floating 18 inches above the desert, moving at about 10 miles per hour toward me before stopping and disappearing behind buildings. Realizing these were intelligent beings with advanced technology, I carefully approached my truck but discovered them huddled in a ditch nearby.
Understanding they were likely a mother and child separated from their family, I stood still to avoid frightening them further. After they climbed from the ditch with difficulty, they floated past me and became trapped at a dead end. Meanwhile, I spotted a third figure, likely Range 4 Harry, who had positioned himself atop a billboard 40 feet high, apparently to help the woman and child. When I turned away, I suddenly received thoughts in my mind that weren't my own, realizing the beings could read and transmit thoughts through the electronics in their helmets. I deliberately thought toward the male, "I will not harm the woman. I will not harm the little girl. I will not you," and waited calmly. The male alien responded telepathically, "I know, you have not been harmed." We established communication, with him instructing me to calm down to improve reception. The male needed to help the woman and child reach safety, so I stood still by the theodolite while he communicated with them. Through his electronics, I could hear their conversation. The woman was terrified, believing I would harm them, while the male reassured her I knew what they were and wouldn't hurt them. After much coaxing, the woman finally floated across the open space to the billboard where the male waited, followed by the less frightened child. After they were safely reunited, the male thanked me for my hospitality and I retreated to my weather shack. One day, Payne revealed that after I left Mojave Wells early to see Pamela, Brian had discovered a young woman in my barracks. She identified herself as the teacher and was waiting specifically for me. She appeared to be about 19, well-dressed in a nice dress with long sleeves, gloves, white stockings, and flat shoes. Brian noted her unusually light complexion, careful English pronunciation, and that she held something like a pencil. She expressed concern about my well-being, saying she enjoyed being around me because I was happy and interesting, and that I had been patient with her and the children. She mentioned her little girl particularly loved being around me. When Brian walked her toward the trailer park, she suddenly ran ahead at impossible speed, vanishing into the desert. Later, after receiving strict orders about my psychological testing appointment, I arrived at a deserted medical facility. Inside, I encountered an unusual receptionist, unusually tall, thin, wearing a wig, gloves, and excessive clothing despite the warm weather. She remained bent over behind the counter, never fully revealing her face, keeping only her right temple directed toward me. The building was eerily empty, yet I sensed two unseen people standing in a back room and another person, presumably the neurosurgeon, waiting down the hall. The lights remained off and the thermostat was set unusually high. After 30 minutes of waiting while experiencing strange thought patterns, the receptionist instructed me to see the man in the end office at exactly 2 p.m., then departed without ever fully showing herself. The neurosurgeon turned out to be an armed man in a business suit who displayed detailed knowledge of my hometown yet lacked knowledge about San Francisco, where the real neurosurgeon was from. His fearful reaction to my mention of the receptionist confirmed my suspicion that this was a security debriefing rather than a psychological examination. When I probed further about the receptionist's excessive clothing, he revealed she risked illness by being outside so early in spring. He asked about my thoughts in the reception area, and I described a pleasant daydream about playing with an intelligent little girl on the ranges while her mother watched from the sagebrush. This pleased him greatly. He then gave me strict instructions to leave through the back door without returning to reception and issued extraordinary orders. I alone would be stationed at Mojave Wells indefinitely, with complete freedom to go anywhere on the ranges day or night, while all other observers required strict supervision and immediate debriefing. I was to identify myself as teacher's pet, if asked my name. When I questioned why I was chosen, he cited my patience, ability to keep my wits about me, reasoning skills, and courage, especially for facing the receptionist without fear. The next day, the Major and Master Sergeant Walters officially delivered these same unusual orders. On a rainy Christmas Eve, I was working a double shift at the Desert Center weather station so others could be with their families. Close to midnight, the phone rang. It was banned from Palm Meadows Field in panic. Two 707 jetliners with passengers were circling with minimal fuel remaining, unable to land at Palm Meadows due to severe thunderstorms. All other airports were closed. Dan's desperate plan was to crash land them on the highway near Desert Center, with emergency vehicles and TV crews already positioned. The planes had only 35 and 20 minutes of fuel left. I refused this plan, instead instructing him to have the planes transferred to Desert Center Towers control. Despite everyone's skepticism about landing in zero visibility conditions, I noticed the storms had been avoiding the mountains north of the runway. Between storms, there were 15-20-minute breaks with smooth winds and visibility holes. I guided both planes to miraculous landings through small visibility holes in the storm, with the second plane's engines quitting just as the nose wheel touched down. The passengers erupted in cheers, while the flight crew was overcome with emotion. The head stewardess informed the tower that the pilot had led everyone in prayer, thanking God for my help. Later, Master Sergeant Walters called to inform me I would receive a medal for heroism, noting that even radar records showed landing was impossible during such severe storms. "No one could have done it but you," he said. "You are one fine paperback hero." What I couldn't explain to anyone was my growing suspicion that I hadn't been alone in guiding those planes to safety. The unusual weather pattern, storms avoiding the northern runway, the precise timing of visibility holes, the strange feeling of being guided, all suggested intervention beyond my own abilities. Had my unusual desert friends played a role in saving those planes? The timing of the storms, the visibility holes, and my inexplicable confidence all pointed to something beyond mere coincidence or skill. Throughout my time at Mojave Wells and Desert Center, I developed coping mechanisms to maintain my sanity while living between two worlds. I described how I'd handle the mysterious door that kept being propped open despite my efforts to secure it. I would lock it, stay up watching it until midnight, even leave lights on. Yet morning after morning, it would be propped open. This realization terrified me because it meant whoever was opening it could monitor my sleep from somewhere in the desert. To protect my sanity, I eventually trained myself to ignore these occurrences, simply closing the door each morning without questioning, ignoring desert lights, and walking to my truck singing happy songs, sometimes praying every step of the way. I created what I called the happy charade, a deliberate psychological strategy of denial and selective attention that allowed me to function in an environment that defied rational explanation. During another supply run to Desert Center, the Chief Master Sergeant questioned me about why I'd lasted at Mojave Wells when previous observers had fled. He asked how close danger would need to come before I'd feel threatened, before I'd decide God isn't watching. I admitted my limit was about 3/4 of a mile, marked by a ridge 1,200 yards from my position. On my return journey, my truck's generator belt broke, leaving me stranded at a rest area. While waiting for help, a speeding Cadillac entered the rest area at 80 miles per hour, missing me by less than an inch, yet not touching a single hair or thread of my clothing. In that moment, I felt God answering the sergeant's question, showing me he didn't even need 3/4 of an inch to protect me. This experience reinforced my belief that despite the strangeness of my situation, I was being protected, whether by God, by the beings themselves, or by some combination of forces I couldn't fully comprehend. This belief allowed me to continue my duties at Mojave Wells when others had fled in terror, to maintain my sanity when faced with the impossible, and to eventually document my experiences in what would become millennial hospitality. Charles Hall's extraordinary account stands as a unique document of sustained contact between humans and non-human intelligences. Contact characterized not by invasion or abduction, but by cautious mutual observation, occasional communication, and what appears to be an officially sanctioned coexistence. His story challenges us to reconsider not just whether we are alone in the universe, but how contact with other intelligences might actually unfold, not with dramatic landings on the White House lawn, but through quiet encounters in remote desert valleys under the watchful eyes of Arcturus.